Dr. Deb Hirshhorn, and this is Do Your Children Receive the Messages You Think You're Giving? I believe that there are four core components of love, which we're going to get to. But I wanted to start with a story. Okay, Sarah Rosenblatt could feel the tension building up in her. The baby was crying. The 20-month-old was screaming. Kiwi was dawdling over his homework. Tippy was complaining about school. And Dina would not stop annoying Rifki. Finally, Sarah could not help herself. And there's a picture of her. Isn't that a great picture? And she lets it rip. It's not so much that she screams, but when she screams, she says, "Get out of my face so I don't have to look at you." So here's my question. What message does she think she's giving, and what message is her little girl, Dina, who she's screaming at, getting? Feel free to answer, but if you're shy or don't want to, it's totally okay, and I'll answer. So I think my position is that she would say, "I am expressing my frustration. These kids should know better. I have told them 1,000 times not to do this or they should do that. I've told them. They know. I'm expressing my frustration." That's not the message the kid is getting. The kid is getting total rejection. And by the way, this is a true story. Somebody told it to me. And the person who related to me said, "I didn't know what to say to this person. I didn't know how to respond. It was a friend of mine." When you're frustrated, the child doesn't need to know that you're frustrated. It doesn't help the child do the right thing to know that you are frustrated. Because their brain is developing at a certain rate of speed, and a young child, and even an adolescent child's brain is not there yet with the level of compassion, understanding, and complex thinking to put themselves in your shoes as to how frustrated they are. Maybe a high school kid would. Maybe not, depending on the child. But really, the message you want to convey is only what they have to do, not how frustrated you are. Is there anyone who want to argue or have a question on that?
So is it okay then if you give them this message but not in a yelling tone?
I think "get out of my face so I don't have to look at you" is really wrong.
Perhaps that you don't use this expression. Let's say you say, "I would really appreciate if you stop bothering your sister."
You don't even have to say, "I would really appreciate." Stop bothering your sister. Is that clear? I see nothing wrong with displaying that level of firmness. That level of authority, if you really, we're normal human beings. We get frustrated, we get angry, we lose it. But when we lose it, please don't say something that you really don't want the kid to hear.
So tone and anger is okay, or tone and anger is not okay? Because
in an ideal world, it's not the best thing to do. The Torah says that anger is like worshiping idols. Why? Why is anger like worshiping idols? See, I've looked into that one because it's what I do. It's because idol worship is the failure of recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu above. Anger is the same thing. It's saying it's all about me. That's why I said the kid doesn't have to hear your frustration. It doesn't matter that you're frustrated. It's not all about me. You're here to do a job. If you reported to your employer for work and got angry, they call that going postal, right? They take a gun and they start shooting up everyone in the post office. We're not supposed to do that at work. Well, this is our job. parenting's our job. The anger just doesn't belong there. It's not about me. It's I have a job. My job is to teach my children how to be menschlichkeit human beings. So therefore, the anger really doesn't belong. However, I'm saying we are normal human beings and sometimes we lose it. And I say, please work hard on losing it less to such a degree. You know what I'm saying? Work hard on it. No, it's not good, but if you happen to do it once in a blue moon, the world will not come to an end and the kids will still grow up normal. But what you say, the messages that you're conveying are very important. You should never stop loving your child, even when you're angry at them. And if at the moment you're angry, because it's all about me at this moment and how frustrated I am, and you really don't love your kid at that moment, don't say it. Don't say it. Hold that back. Don't let the kid think that for 2 seconds, ever. That's the point. So I ask the question, is Dina getting this message from the screaming or from the words? I'd say it's both. So these are the four components that I feel make up love and relationship. Attachment, giving, respect, and valuing. So let's look at attachment and successful communication. So here is a cool picture, and I want to talk about the neurological basis of attachment. And if anybody here in this room is interested in that kind of thing, which I think is just very, very cool, because it's how Hashem created our brains, and we'd like to understand how the brain really relates to what we call the mind and the way we think. This is Daniel J. Siegel. He is a neurobiologist, happens to obviously be Jewish. I don't know if he's from, but it's about the mind and the brain, the connection between how brains develop it. I just think it's very cool. Okay. We have 12 cranial nerves, but 3 of them go to the eyes. So in the brain, 1/4 of all our nerves go to the eyes. You don't even have to write it because I've got it here. Now listen to this. 10% of blind children learn to live and work independently, but 95% of deaf children do. We were meant to be visual. We're visual. Okay, so therefore, one of the key elements of communicating is eye contact. This is where I'm going with this. When you're talking to your child, look at them. When you're talking to your spouse, look at them. Yeah. So here's this incredible experiment. This is what they did. They made a plastic floor, a plexiglass floor where you could see through to the floor beneath. It would be very scary for a young child to be crawling across this floor because they would feel like they were going to drop down to the next. And there was a walkway, pathway put on there for the child to crawl across a certain distance. And these babies were one, and mom was on the other side, and here was the experiment. They would, quote-unquote, tell the child to come across or not, depending on the condition in the experiment, only with their eyes. Only with their eyes. No voice. No facial expression. Just their eyes. And what they found was that 80 out of 20 would go ahead. When told not to, 17 out of 20 wouldn't. And that research is here. After this, if you have a few minutes and you want to look it up, it's just fascinating, childhood development. J. Campos, C-A-M-P-O-S, was the author of that experiment. So what it's saying is that attachment begins with the eyes. And looking at your child is a way to communicate and how you look at your child. So let me say this. If you've been practicing good eye contact from the earliest ages with your children, and you're really, really, really mad at them because they did not do what you were supposed to do, trust me, you don't even need to say anything. You could be angry with your eyes and they'll get the message.
Is that why when your child is securely attached to you, if they've done something wrong, they can't make eye contact with you?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's amazing. I have a three-month-old granddaughter, and I, as I said in my first talk, this one here, this is my house basically underwater, and I'm living with my daughter and son-in-law and my husband and my other son and five grandchildren, because our house doesn't exist right now. And so every time this little baby needs to be picked up because she's upset and my daughter's busy with whatever, I mean, she's 3 months old, I just look at her and she gloms onto my eyes. It's amazing. And she quiets down. So my kids used to have this joke that look number five, you know. So why kill an ant with a sledgehammer? Why scream? Why say nasty things? Just start getting used to it. If you haven't done it up till now, put the phone down, you know, whatever. When you're talking to your kid, look your kid in the eye. And get used to that and let them get used to it so that you have that connection. I think that's a major part of attachment. And this picture with the two brains talked about is, I'm going to get into this. This is a piece of research in which the researchers were trying to find out how the brain works. And they had certain areas, they had electrodes on monkeys, and they were doing their study and they broke for lunch. And one of the researchers, I guess, got hungry. He had not disconnected all the wires. And he started eating a banana. And the parts of the brain where the person, it would show when they were eating in the brain, lit up on the monitor for the monkey that was still attached. The man was eating the banana, and the monkey's brain for eating lit up. And that was the discovery of mirror neurons. And they believe that mirror neurons are the basis of empathy. Isn't that fascinating how Hashem created us? That we see somebody else experiencing something and it's as if we did. That's empathy. So, did you want to say something? So, this again talks about how important it is to just look, connect quietly. You don't need all these words that are... Okay, more brain stuff. Here's another piece that's really important about anger. There are two pictures. The first one shows that this front part of the brain right here, the prefrontal cortex, is the thinking part of the brain. That's the part that reasons. Okay. Now, you turn the page and we have another picture of the brain where you notice this part again would have been the prefrontal cortex. This part with all these lines going with these names is the part that feels emotions and experiences emotions. And there's a whole process when we're angry in which the prefrontal cortex that thinks shuts off, just not there. Instead, all this stuff is active, the limbic system. And this explains why if you're angry, no one can reason with you. If your child is angry, you can't reason with him. This is not the time for reasoning. What is it the time to do?
React.
Well, they will react, but what should you do? Let's put it this way. If you are angry or they're angry and you want to have a conversation, you have to calm down first. They won't even feel empathy. You have to calm down. You take a deep breath. Take a walk a little bit around the room, go into another room and count to 60, whatever it takes to calm down. Think of a place that you like to go to for a vacation or to retreat. Just get your head into a different place so that you can reconnect the part of your brain that thinks and disconnect all this emotional stuff that is not going to help you. If you're angry, if the kid's angry, you tell him to take a deep breath. You could breathe with him. Seriously, I would. Because it's not going to work otherwise. He's not going to think. So being angry, and this page here just goes over what I just said. He's not going to work. On thinking or solving his problem when he's angry or when you're angry. Now, let's just stay with the anger a minute. When you're angry, what happens to the other person? They develop a fear response. The normal response to anger is fear. Well, if we go back to the picture of the brain where it's just emotional, they can't think. So if they're afraid of your anger, the one thing you wanted to do, get a message across, you are shooting yourself in your own foot. Gesundheit.
Thank you.
So that really will answer your question. It's not okay to get angry because you're not even going to accomplish your own goal. So the cerebral cortex shuts down. You cannot receive the information you're getting. Go back to Sarah Rosenblatt's story. The more eye contact, the more in sync the mother and child will be. And now we've gotten that idea of how Sarah's anger will stand in the way of her message. So I think the conclusion is we have to take care of ourselves. And if we get angry, the first thing we have to do is take care of ourselves by getting ourselves calmed down. I had a client who I work with. She had 5 children also. And I taught her. I gave her scripts what to say to the kids. But she had to learn to calm down first. One time she was in the car. She was about to flip like this woman in the picture. This is normal, especially during carpool. She pulled off the road. She got out of the car. She locked the car with the key. She had the key in her hand. And she walked around the car breathing until she calmed down. And she had the script in her hand, and she finally came back in the car and read the script to the kids so that she got them under control. Because you can't work when you're, this is the point, if you're out of it, you're just, you know. Okay, let's go on to the next section here. Giving. Successful communication and giving. So I have a thumbs up here. What's this all about? This is just about giving feedback. Just letting a kid know, good job. And see, this is, you don't even have to say it. Remember, we're mostly visual. The kid just sees this, and he knows you're pleased. He did something right, you know? Because there are many kinds of giving. Now, let me give you a real definition of positive reinforcement. Positive reinforcements are used, the word is used as rewards, but not exactly. A positive reinforcement, by definition, increases the behavior. That's the definition. So, if child, let's say, is not getting the attention that he wants and he acts badly, and you come after him for that behavior and you're all like worked up and frothing at the mouth, you've just given him attention. And if he wants attention because he's not getting it, you've just positively reinforced behavior that you really don't want. You all with me on this? Okay. So positive reinforcement means something that you do to increase behavior. So you have to be always careful to figure out what it is you need to give the child that will increase their behavior. It could be a physical thing, a verbal thing, or a nonverbal communication. So if 2-year-old Ellie is crying and you give him a cookie, besides the fact that now that he's eating, he's no longer crying, what are you doing with his behavior? You've reinforced the crying.
If you cry hard enough, you'll get something out of mommy.
And one of my grandsons, I don't know that he became a big whiner. He's the 5-year-old because this was done, or it was just his personality that he was a whiner, or it was because he was number 3 down and he became a whiner. But actually, when he starts to whine, his parents will say, okay, now you're not going to get, in a very quiet way so that it's not attention, and now you're not going to get whatever it was he was whining about. You have to stop crying. Use your words. Use your words. That's such a good thing for a parent to say to a kid who's, yeah. And then he'll say, I wanted, can you say it without whining? I wanted, yes. Now I'm all ears. What did you want? Whatever it is. Deciding what to give depends on the child's age, the child's language acquisition. When giving a physical thing, always pair it for young children with verbal feedback, because the goal is that as the child grows, you want to give more verbal and fewer physical things. And I appreciate, I see you all nodding, I appreciate that there are people who don't get that. They give a lot of physical things. One case, if you know people in this situation, one case where this comes up, unfortunately, is divorce, where parents feel so bad for the child because of a divorce that they tend to overgive physical things. And they don't have the mind or the heart, they're too disturbed to give the kind of emotional attention that the child really needs. And they substitute the physical things for it, it's not helpful. It's not at all helpful. Basically, the message a child gets when they're getting lots and lots of material things with not that much attention is, don't bother me, leave me alone. It's almost the same message as Sarah Rosenblatt gave her children in the screaming episode, leave me alone, don't bother me. You aren't important. Here, leave me alone. So you have to be very careful with physical things. You don't want to give too much of them. Hanukkah's coming up. How much money do we have to spend on Hanukkah gifts? And I'm not saying you should deprive your child. God forbid. You don't want to give so little that they feel they really didn't get anything. But where do you draw the line? You can go to Amazing Savings and buy some toy for $5, and it's really good enough, depending on the age of the child. Any questions on that? Arguments?
I don't give Hanukkah presents, but in general, what about if other kids in the class get X, Y, and Z, and your child is the quote-unquote only one?
Yeah.
First of all, it's probably not true that they're the only one.
Yeah.
That's probably not true. I would, my first reaction to the child would be, ah, come on, nice try. And I make a joke of it like that because I think humor is wonderful. It's a wonderful form of, you and I are on the same page. We're a team. We're together. you know, instead of against, adversarial kind of a thing. So right away, nice try. And it also shows you're smart enough to not be manipulated. And then you could say to the child, why do you want this, whatever it is, so badly? And let them explain it to you. And you can hear, is there a passion? I mean, do they like art and there's a drawing thing? I mean, or is it one of these toys that they're going to play with for 15 minutes and get bored of? You know? So I would inquire a little bit and find out. But I raised 4. My daughter's raising 5. My son's raising 3. And it never came up that a physical object, toy kind of thing, was really that important. And we were on a budget. And I don't think they were hurt by it. So... any reactions? Okay. Now, let's talk about unearned treats. 2-year-old Morty is just sitting there doing nothing. You give him a kiss and a hug. What message are you giving?
That you love the child.
Right. He doesn't have to always do something. That's another piece of communication. Some parents are very, which is nice, very success-oriented. They want their child to do well in school. And all reinforcement and all attention is all about their performance. It's good, but it's not good if that's all there is. There's got to be the unearned piece. I love you for who you are. And you don't have to do a thing. Just be you. And I love you. And that's good enough. That should be a component of all relationships. So this Morty, interestingly enough, will probably perform better in school than the kid who gets reinforcements only for performing. Isn't that odd? It's a paradoxical kind of a reaction to life. But the reason is because this Morty wants to make his parents happy because he knows they love him and care about him. So he's going to do well in school. If he can, he'll do the best he can just because they love him. And the bond, the connection between them is so much more important than getting stuff. So now Morty is 20. He goes away to college. He needs a computer, and you give him a computer. Is that the same thing as when he was 2 years old and he got a kiss and a hug for no reason?
No.
Why?
He's showing a need for something and you're responding to the need. It's almost as like a 2-year-old is crying.
Okay.
And you're giving him the thing that he wants.
Okay. So should you give him the computer?
If he needs it, I mean.
Okay.
If you're goal-oriented, then you probably would give it to him anyway. And if you think that it's something, you know, like changing the diaper or giving him food or something like that.
Yeah, I would agree with you. That's where I'm coming from, too. If he's been a good kid and he's doing just what he needs to do, then let him get the computer. He doesn't need to have the most expensive computer. The computer that'll do the job.
If he's 17 and he needs a car.
Does he need the car to get to work? Because he's such a good boy that he's got an after-school job and he's doing volunteer work with one of these wonderful organizations and he's needs the car to get around. I mean, if he lives in Brooklyn, he doesn't need a car. I don't know where you... Well, you know, it depends. I really, really feel these things depend on who the child is. And is this a child who's been whining for things he needs his whole life? Or is this a child who's very resourceful and independent and so forth? And you're giving him a car because it'll be good for him. It'll help him.
What about a child who never asks for anything?
So there are two reasons, there are a couple of reasons why a child would never ask for anything. One reason is because he's given everything before he even thinks about it, which may not be a good thing. I mean, you do want to meet all your child's needs. But if a child has a home in which everything he might want is given to him, then he, this goes back to the earlier session I gave on fostering independence, he might not realize what his needs are to express them. It's not good. He needs to be able to know what he wants and needs so that he can express them and ask for them. Another alternative reason why a child might not ask for anything is that he sees in his environment that that's a bad thing to do. That for some reason you get hurt in the process of asking for something. I was just working with a client who told me growing up it would never occur to her to ask for anything because her parents, well, one parent was not there most of the time, and the other parent that was there was unable emotionally to handle disturbing things, problems, negative things, issues. The mother simply didn't have a capacity for problems and negativity. So the child became, in a sense, a protector of the mother by never asking for anything. And there's an expression, I don't like using psychobabble, but there's an expression for that, a parentified child. A child that's almost taking care of the parent's needs first because they're afraid that the parent can't handle it. So that's not good either. And then there might be a child that's temperamentally just easygoing. Could be. So before I could answer which one that would fit into, I'd have to have a lot more information. But those are possibilities that pop into my head from that question. So what can we conclude about giving and successful communication? That's a question for you to go home and think about, and I don't want to spend time away from going forward with just, you know, recapping what we've just talked about. The next section is respect and successful communication. Okay, should you be respectful to a misbehaving child?
Yes, because otherwise they're going to get up.
Thank you. I agree. How do you get the message across that you're angry? Given what I said before about anger, I feel it's a juggling act. I can't quote where, but it says in the Gemara that a parent may need to act like they're angry sometimes. We shouldn't be angry because we get that brain thing of the cerebral cortex being cut off, so we don't want to be angry. But sometimes we do want to give that message to the child that what they said, did, or otherwise was not welcome and that we're really displeased. Because if we had this connection that we want, the child doesn't want to displease us. So, like I said before, the look. Excuse me. My goodness, that is so powerful. You don't have to come. Excuse me. It works. If your child is used to having this quiet connection, and if they aren't, as I said, just start building that up with a lot of eye contact and less words, and just really connecting, it only takes a little to get them veered into the right direction. Should you get the message across that you are angry, and now you know what I'm going to say from what we've said before. Yes, but not really angry. You want to get the message that they need to work on their behavior. It's still you have to be in control of your brain. That's why it's, can you convey anger without being angry? Benefits. Here's the benefits of not getting angry when you're really feeling like you need your child to know something. And I have this wonderful picture I pulled off the internet of a child and a baby. And you see, instead of sibling rivalry, you're fostering good relationship among siblings, because if you're not angry, they won't be angry. They will learn to think more and react less. And you'll teach them all kinds of good ways of getting along with one another as well as with you.
So you would even banish the word anger from your vocabulary? Would you say, I'm displeased with you?
You could say the word angry as long as you know what you're doing. I remember you're bringing me back. I remember when my kids were like 11, 12, 9, 10, whatever, something like that. And I would go, what did you say? Like that. And they would like, okay, I got to get my act together. They'd do whatever.
And you said that without raising your voice.
Yeah. And then when they left, I was like, having trouble not giggling because I thought they were cute, or I thought they were really funny, or I thought they were something, that a message positively that I didn't want to reinforce because they did something wrong, even though they were cute. Maybe they were chutzpahdik, but it was cute. Do you know what I'm saying? I would giggle, but I looked like I was angry. But I didn't want them to see me giggling. When they got older, they could see me giggling because they were smart enough to realize what Eva was doing behind her hand, or whatever. Do you see what I'm saying? The anger is something you use. It's a tool to help them learn. Your job as a parent is to teach a kid. Every tool at your disposal, use it. But your brain and your heart have to be in charge. Okay, the next section here, and we're doing, I think, very well time-wise, is valuing. Valuing and successful communication. Okay, so you value your child, but it's not enough. Valuing has pieces to it. So here's a picture of a child building blocks. What if the parent loves that child and values that child so much that he helps with the child's play too much? Here, put the block here. Put the block here. What's happening? What's the message the child is getting? You're valuing the child, but you're also helping too much, so you're also giving what message?
You're not good enough.
Yes, exactly. Isn't that interesting? Here you're getting the exact opposite message across that you wanted, just by helping. I never did science papers or science projects with my kids. Never. I refused. I would always tell them, I'm not in ninth grade, or I'm not in seventh grade, whatever it was. I did that already. It's your job. You can do it. What if, out of abundant love, the parent kisses the child at this moment when the child's playing with the blocks? Oh, you're so cute! What message is the child getting?
Good job.
Yes.
Also, it's a little.
But look at the kid's face. The kid is concentrating here.
Right. You're disturbing the child.
You're disturbing the child. So you're giving two mixed messages. The message on one hand is, I love you. That's coming across. And the other is, what you're doing is not that important. I hate to say it, but that's the message. Right there, the kid is concentrating. You have to put yourself in the child's shoes a little bit. The kid's doing something. Give the child a little space. Hold your breath. See if the block ends up right on top. And when the kid goes and smiles pleased with him, then you can kiss him. Great job. I love you. Can do things well. What's important to the child, you have to recognize is important. even if you personally don't think it is. So valuing requires sensitivity for successful communication. One way to get that sensitivity is to shut off the stream of thoughts in your own head and focus on your child and where she is coming from at that moment. And that is a great exercise if you're having problems with your boss at work or your spouse or your sister or your parent or anything else. Where is this other person coming from? Because that's how you can really overcome a lot of obstacles. And that's why I have these little shoes with the big shoes. Step into, figuratively, your child's shoes. How does the world look from that person's point of view? Now, valuing may not be an automatic thing. It's great if it was, but it may not be. We get busy with our lives. The kid is getting in the way. We forget that our job is to educate them, and we think, well, we have to make dinner, and we have to make a home, and we have to be a provider. We do. We have all those things to do. So it can get in the way. How do we get it back? And I found this great picture, which I think represents it. I have this man watching his kid sleeping. And you know, sometimes when your kid is sleeping, you have that sweet, sweet feeling inside. Ah, yes, that is how I really feel about my child. I think we need to do that a lot. We need to stop in the middle of all the turmoil and hubbub in the household and remember the sweetness of who this child is and who the child means to me or used to mean to me before they became so aggravating to me. You don't have to go watch them sleep. And if they're no longer a little baby, you shouldn't go in there and watch them sleep. But the point is, get that picture back in your mind to value who the child is. Does anybody have any questions or arguments or whatever on valuing and what I've said? Because I think it's hard. As the child becomes older and has an independent mind, hopefully they will, it becomes hard sometimes to value them when they're not even in the same place where you thought they should be or you wanted them to be or whatever. By the way, just before I go on to the next section of this, I'll just tell a wonderful story I heard, and don't remember how I heard it, how I came by it. I think a Rav gave a Shabbos here. Some man came to this Rav and said that his child was off the derech, and the child was living at home, teenager, and what do I do? And the Rav and the man were talking and kind of going over the usual pattern of how the family handled the daily routine. And apparently this father would prepare nagelwasser for each child and put it in a little bowl under each child's bed every day. And he had stopped doing it for this child who went off the derech because he didn't care, he didn't use it. So the Rav said, no. Do it for this child. Show him that you care about him. The father did it for 6 months, came back to the Rav and said, not working. Be patient, the Rav said. Keep doing it. A year and a half later, he came back and said, one morning, my son put his arms around me and said, thank you. That's valuing.